avid viewing of BJ and the Bear and McCloud, and completely unburdened by the inhibitions that restrain most people from striking up conversations with total strangers. On the rare occasions I was allowed to sit in the front seat, I took full advantage of my access to the CB handset, adopting the handle Blue Thunder, a nod to our Titanic Lincoln. I launched into monologues of breathtaking incomprehensibility. Breaker Breaker 1020, Blue Thunder here, gobbling up the zipper dashes like Pac-Man rolling for a power pill. Looking for some good buddies out there to croak back a 10-4 on, any hungry Smokey the Bears looking to chase down a fire chicken on roller skates. Roger Dodger, out and over. Anyone tuning in must have thought I was in dire need of psychiatric treatment. Most often, my nonsensical call-outs were met with silence. But occasionally, someone who figured out I was just a dumb kid would take pity on me and respond. We'd then engage in some awkward conversation about where we were headed, what mile marker we were currently passing, and such. I'd try to force in some out-of-context references to cornfield Cadillacs and county Mounties. Finally, Papa Bear would snatch the handset away and suggest we just listen to some music instead. But my efforts weren't in vain. Thanks to my rambling and the mindless musings of millions of other ratchet jaws, novice CB users flooding the airwaves, most real truckers either cut way back on using their CBs or turn them off altogether. I may not be able to take credit for the demise of disco or those outrageously heeled shoes called clogs, but I can honestly say I played a role in bringing the CB craze to a merciful end. Despite the tools at our disposal to help us avoid tickets, there were still places where speeding just wasn't worth the risk. As we repeatedly traveled the same highways over the years, we got to know these areas well. These high-risk zones were made apparent by the sheer number of aggravated drivers we'd see pulled over at the side of the road. The Illinois-Wisconsin border was always a speed trap, as was the short stretch between Chicago and Gary, Indiana. Southern Indiana and Illinois were relatively safe, as was most of Kentucky. It was best to back off the accelerator in Arkansas. Tennessee offered relatively clear sailing, but it was wise to tap the brakes in parts of Alabama. Finally, there was one place we knew without question where it was never a good idea to push our luck, where both sides of the highway always seemed to be lined with flashing lights, like the gutters of a house decorated for Christmas. That place was Georgia. There is perhaps no other state in America better positioned to balance its budget by handing out speeding tickets to out-of-state motorists than Georgia. After all, Georgia's southern border stretches across nearly three-quarters of the state of Florida, home to many of the most popular tourist destinations in America. Next to California, no other state attracts more tourists, most traveling by car, than Florida. And except for a few motorists entering Florida along its panhandle from Alabama, all traffic heading south into the state, on the way to Disney World, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, the Space Coast, and other top destinations, has no choice but to cross hundreds of miles of Georgia Highway. Since the advent of the automobile, no one has been more aware of this fact than the Georgia Highway Patrol. Hard data are difficult to gather for the 1960s and 1970s due to the difficulties of collecting records from multiple jurisdictions. However, according to the National Motorists Association, only one U.S. state handed out more traffic tickets in 2010 than Georgia. That state? Florida. What's more, the AAA has for decades advised motorists to beware of overly vigilant law enforcement on Highway 301, a particularly perilous passage between the two states. It's along this highway that one can find the tiny hamlet that helped cement Georgia's reputation for being particularly, even unlawfully, hard on out-of-state motorists. Ludowice. At one point, this small town drew national attention for setting the most crooked speed trap in America. It was a place so notorious for shaking down Yankee motorists that even Georgia's own governor, Lester Maddox, once described Ludowice as lousy, rotten, corrupt, nasty, and no good. And he never even got pulled over there. In the days before interstates, Ludovisi sat squarely on the trigger of the Georgia speed trap. Situated at the junction of three federal highways, 301, 25, and 84, Ludovisi was the main gateway into Florida throughout the 1950s and 1960s. Only 1,000 residents lived in Ludovisi, but more than 1 million motorists passed through the town every year. Seeing all those happy tourists stop to fill their gas tanks and pay with crisp $20 bills, unscrupulous town leaders and business owners schemed more ways to profit from their prime location. At first, the shakedown was limited to aggressively enforcing traffic laws. At the edge of Ludovisi, where the posted speed limit dropped dramatically without warning, the town's patrol officers waited to pounce on any driver who didn't react in time. They didn't even use speed guns to nab alleged violators. The speed of an offending motorist was simply estimated by the officer, using his best professional judgment. But things quickly took a shady turn. The town's single stoplight was rigged with a switch located behind a nearby billboard. As an unsuspecting motorist entered the intersection, the switch would be flipped, changing the light instantly from green to red, at which point the driver would be chased down by a patrol car waiting in an adjacent alley. Local residents knew to take a side street bypassing the intersection, ensuring the ploy caught only drivers from out of town. Essentially, Ludovisi became a sort of tourist turnstile at the entrance to Florida, only one at which tickets were handed out instead of collected. According to a story by Morris Shelton appearing in the St. Petersburg News, a newspaper from a nearby town in Florida, on July 5, 1970, Ludovisi police issued tickets totaling $43,000 over a single four-month period. One woman received a ticket on entering the town and another on leaving it. Authorities at multiple levels were in on the action. For each ticket they issued, patrol officers were paid $2.50. Long County, where Ludovisi is located, cleared $15 per summons. Offending motorists were expected to pay cash on the spot or be forced to appear before the local magistrate at his convenience, which could be days later. In total, Ludovisi was said to have relieved motorists of more than $100,000 in fines annually throughout the 1960s. The town's corruption didn't end with the police. Dodgy local business owners also appeared to be in on the money grab. When drivers stopped at a local service station and requested to have their oil level checked, attendants allegedly disabled the cars by tinkering with their generators or pouring water into their crankcases. When their vehicles wouldn't start, motorists would be directed to a nearby garage for repairs, for an outrageous sum. The name of the repair shop's owner? Billy Swindle. Unsurprisingly, scores of irate motorists who'd been bilked in Ludovisi lodged complaints with state authorities. Fearing the town's unseemly practices were tarnishing the reputation of the entire state, which of course they were, three different Georgia governors attempted to force Ludovisi to clean up its act, without success. At one point, Governor Lester Maddox even threatened to move the state capital to Ludovisi, giving him jurisdictional authority over local officials. Maddox settled for posting state-funded billboards leading into town from every direction offering drivers the following warning. Beware. You are in Long County and approaching Ludovisi, Georgia. Don't get fleeced in a clip joint. Don't get caught in a speed trap. By the time the billboards appeared in 1970, however, Ludovisi's days of squeezing motorists were already numbered. East of town, the new I-95 superhighway was already under construction. When it opened 2 years later, the interstate offered travelers from the Northeast a faster, more direct route to the Sunshine State. Shortly after, I-75 opened to the west, doing the same for motorists traveling from the Midwest. But Ludovisi's crooked schemes had garnered national notoriety. The town even earned its own spread in Time magazine, in an issue dated April 27, 1970. Ludovisi's infamy bolstered Georgia's reputation as a place where out-of-state motorists had to be wary. By the time my family came trundling down I-75 in the late 1970s, it appeared that nothing much had changed. Even my dad conceded that Georgia was one place it made no sense to push the limit. From the day the first speed limit was posted, motorists and patrol officers have sought to outwit each other in a fiercely contested game of cat and mouse. But it was a game my dad had mastered. Not once in more than a decade of our family's travels, covering tens of thousands of miles of open highway, was my father ever stopped for speeding. What's more, if he were still around, I know he'd take great pride in pointing out we always made good time.
While Dad had to keep a sharp eye out for the fuzz in the front seat, my brothers and I were always looking for ways to stay busy in the back seat. After all, we had plenty of free time on our hands, and even more ways to fill it.
Chapter 6. Time to Pass. Diversions, Directions, and Discoveries. When you're just 6 years old, a 20-hour road trip represents a significant portion of your lifetime. Trapped in the back seat of a car, squeezed between two hulking teenage brothers, and piled under an assortment of blankets, pillows, jackets, and grocery bags filled with snacks, comic books, and magazines, it's a span of time that seems closer to an eternity. And as any parent knows, if time begins to feel long to a young kid, that kid will make time feel longer for everyone around them. Like all kids, I needed to be provided with an endless stream of diversions, or I'd begin inventing my own, usually involving singing, humming, or some other noisy annoyance. This would begin a predictable series of events, the first of which would be my receiving a swift noogie from one of my brothers. I would respond by bawling hysterically, prompting my dad to snarl, "Don't make me pull over!" and angrily throw his right arm over the front seat to grab the neck of my assailant while struggling to maintain control of the steering wheel with his left hand. He'd veer onto the shoulder, causing my mom to begin screaming at my dad to mind his driving before he got us all killed, at which point my sister would curl into a fetal position in preparation for impact. Just in the nick of time, Dad would swerve back onto the road, and we'd continue on our way. Having barely escaped death, we'd all sit in stunned silence for the next 20 minutes, as though none of it ever happened. On most trips, this would play out a dozen times a day. To prevent this potentially lethal chain of events from unfolding, my mom often took charge of our family entertainment. This was an especially important job as we traveled south of Chicago, when the need for vigilant cop spotting diminished, and the boredom of driving through endless miles of cornfields would set in. She'd begin by initiating the traditional games of I Spy, the license plate game, or the alphabet game, a contest in which we'd try to be the first to spot words on passing billboards or highway signs, starting with each successive letter of the alphabet. Given her prime viewing spot in the middle of the front seat, my sister would generally dominate these competitions, while my brothers would just sink their heads into magazines to avoid participating altogether. Eventually, the rest of us would lose interest as well, at which point my mother would produce the game bag. The game bag was a paper grocery bag filled with every novelty, travel puzzle, and cheap toy my mother could buy at the local dime store. For starters, there were those handheld games in which the object was to navigate a tiny ball bearing through a maze or into the eye holes of a cartoon face. Then I'd move on to the magic slate drawing pad, a rectangle of cardboard with a drawing area covered in a sheet of gray film. Whenever I pressed the film with a thin red stylus, a black line appeared. The sheet of film could then be lifted to erase the image, presenting a blank page for another drawing. Next, there was Wooly Willy, a personal favorite. Wooly Willy was the cartoon face of a nerdy-looking white guy on cardboard, covered with a canopy of clear plastic holding black metal shavings. You used a magnetic pen to pick up the shavings and drop them over Willy's face to create amusing beards, mustaches, and, my preferred embellishment, an enormous afro. Willy didn't seem to mind. Mom would also include several invisible ink books produced by a company called Yes and No.
These books included an invisible ink pen that allowed you to reveal answers to trivia questions, hunt down hidden submarines on printed grids, and play hangman, among other games. But for my money, more accurately Mom's money, no item in the game bag delivered more entertainment than Mad Libs, a series of activity books created by the commendably juvenile minds behind Mad Magazine. Each page of Mad Libs featured a short story with keywords left blank. You filled in these blanks with random suggestions from others. If a noun was required, the author, usually me, asked for a random noun. If a type of animal was needed, I'd ask for animal suggestions, and so on. Finally, the story was read aloud with all the out-of-context suggestions included, and hilarity ensued. A completed Mad Lib might read something like this. The words we added are emphasized. On July 20th, 1969, America became the first country to land a pineapple on the moon. Millions of armadillos all over the world watched on television as the lunar landing module touched down gently on the moon's stinky surface, in an area known as the Sea of Polyester. The mission's landing crew included Commander Neil Armstrong and Edwin Old Blood and Guts Aldrin, while a third astronaut, Gomer Pyle, piloted the unicycle alone in lunar orbit above. As the first human being to set foot on the diaper, Neil Armstrong courageously declared, "This is one small step for a dodo bird, one giant leap for underwear." The duo then spent nearly a full day on the nacho-flavored lunar landscape, collecting boogers and conducting duck-duck-goose. After blasting off from the waterbed, the pair rejoined their colleague, Gomer Pyle, for the return flight back to Toys R Us. The Green Bay Packers had begun the space race with their successful launch of the satellite, Mayor McCheese. But dentists had won the race. When the crew of Tidy Bowl 11 safely splashed down in the ocean and emerged smiling and juggling chainsaws from the capsule as millions of people farted. It was extremely silly and very fun. What made it all the more entertaining was that everyone in the family enjoyed taking their turn to contribute, even my brothers, who avoided participating in every other family activity. Sometimes when I broke out the books after dark, and we were a little giddy from a long day of travel, reading the best Mad Libs aloud would have us nearly convulsing with laughter. It wasn't the sort of travel activity that broadened one's horizons, but it did, for a short while, bring us all a little closer. The fun of Mad Libs sessions could last only so long, however. Sooner or later, I'd overplay my hand and suggest poop as a noun, or fart as a verb once too often, causing my mom to give me the evil eye. Usually, we'd just run out of funny-sounding adjectives and lose interest. Then my mom would hand me the one item in the game bag sure to end my pleas for another round of Mad Libs, the Mattel Electronics handheld football game. Resembling a large LED calculator, the game didn't look very interesting. Except for a small helmeted player molded into the plastic at the bottom, the device didn't appear to have anything to do with football, or, for that matter, fun. The screen where the action happened was tiny, about the size of a stick of gum. The gameplay appeared equally uninspired, a few tiny red LED diodes blinking on a small black grid. The player assumed the role of running back, represented by a bright dash and, much to the little dash's chagrin, I'm certain, was one of just two offensive players on the field. Confronting the player was an army of defenders, represented by equally sized but dimmer red dashes. That's right. The only way to determine the good guys from the bad guys was a slight disparity in how brightly the dashes glowed. As the defensive dashes advanced toward the running back, they constantly changed positions, usually at completely predictable intervals. To elude the menacing minus signs, the player pushed arrow buttons to move his running back up, down, and forward toward the end zone, while attempting to avoid being tackled. The player's computerized companion attempted to throw blocks by positioning itself in front of approaching defenders. Of course, the graphics couldn't actually depict anything as exciting as a tackle, or even show two dashes colliding. Instead, a tackle was indicated by having the two involved dashes simply blink beside each other, as a tinny little speaker spat out a few sad-sounding tones. The player could choose to play against another person or against the computer, selecting one of two skill levels. For an experienced player, it was almost mindlessly easy to beat the computer even on the higher skill setting. In a competition between two veteran players, the loser would nearly always be the player who failed to score a touchdown on just one of his possessions before time expired. At the time of its debut, few thought Mattel's football game would be a success. The game's visuals were so primitive, it made early arcade games like Pong and Breakout seem like virtual reality simulations. In 1977, when the game was originally released, only Sears carried it. Sears quickly determined the game would flop, and production was halted. But Sears couldn't predict how inexplicably thrilling the game would be to kids like me, who were just beginning to experience our first 8-megabyte rushes of adrenaline in the arcades. Soon, Mattel electronic football games were flying off shelves, and production quickly resumed. By early 1978, Mattel was selling 500,000 units a week. Based on the game's monstrous success, Mattel and other game companies scrambled to create similar games, including other sports games and classics like Simon and Merlin. The portable game device market was born, eventually spawning the hugely successful Nintendo Game Boy and other sophisticated handheld game systems. Mattel's primitive yet powerfully addictive electronic football game was named, like the Fuzzbuster, one of Time Magazine's all-time 100 gadgets. The items in the game bag had to meet certain requirements. They couldn't be too big or too noisy, or include too many pieces that could be lost, or angrily hurled at a sibling. Or, with the exception of my Mad Libs booklets, required the participation of more than one player, me. That meant we never brought board games on our road trips like other families did. It wasn't that I wouldn't have wanted to play them. I relished playing games like Candyland, Battleship, Sorry, and Monopoly back home. But for me to play them out on the road, my parents would also had to have brought my friends. As teenage boys, my brothers and backseat traveling companions were far more interested in hot rod magazines, catching some Z's, or doing just about anything besides keeping their kid brother entertained. This precluded me from partaking in one of the more popular pastimes of the prime road trip era, travel chess. Actually, playing chess while en route to a distant destination vastly predated road travel, or even cars. Well-heeled passengers traveling on ships or riding in carriages and stagecoaches had long passed the endless hours of their journeys playing chess using sets with peg-in pieces that fit securely in holes drilled into game boards. But the practice of playing chess while traveling wouldn't truly explode until after World War II. To support the American war effort, the Druecke Company of Grand Rapids, Michigan, once the country's oldest manufacturer of traditional board games, designed and produced pocket versions of popular games including chess. The sets were then shipped by the boxcar load to GIs fighting around the world. Compact, self-contained, and eminently portable, these pocket-sized sets were highly prized by soldiers and went far in popularizing chess among an entirely different class of players. Following the war, Druecke introduced a new version of their portable chess set with flat, disc-shaped magnetic pieces, making the game easy to play anywhere, even the back seat of a moving car. Sales of magnetic travel chess sets exploded as soldiers who'd grown to love the game overseas took their families out on America's highways, and the games continued to sell well into the 1970s. Of course, it only made sense. After all,
Chess is a game of war. While I was dodging diodes in the back seat, my parents and sister were all business up front. In addition to taking charge of our family entertainment, Mom dispensed snacks and beverages, doling out more or less depending on when our next food stop was scheduled. When Dad wasn't swinging an arm over the front seat to keep the peace, he was vigilantly scanning the road for Smokies. That left Leslie to fill the role of chief navigation officer. In an era before GPS and smartphones, it was a critical job. With far fewer exits back then and much smaller built-up areas around cities, a wrong turn or missed exit often meant traveling 10 miles or farther down the interstate to find a turnaround. Or worse. Every kid under the age of 12 in those days had heard the terrifying stories of families who got off at an incorrect exit, ran into a band of homicidal fiends, and were never heard from again. These stories appeared to be based entirely in legend, at least until 1995, when a Los Angeles family returning from a cookout made a wrong turn into an alley claimed by a local gang, calling themselves the Avenues. The gang members riddled the car with bullets, killing a 3-year-old girl and injuring her stepfather and brother. Fortunately for us, highway navigation had come a long way since the days of the Blue Books and their directions to turn right when you come to the large oak stump. Map publisher Rand McNally had begun producing roadmaps in 1904 and published its first road atlas in 1924 under the more colorful title Rand McNally Auto Chum. Chum meaning friend or pal, rather than the word's more modern use, a slurry of fish guts dumped over the side of a boat to attract sharks for Discovery Channel TV specials. Realizing better maps encouraged motorists to travel more and consequently to consume more fuel, Gulf Oil Company contracted Rand McNally to print road maps for free distribution at its service stations beginning in 1920. The idea proved so popular that every major oil company soon followed suit. Service stations continued to provide free maps, which also helpfully highlighted the chain's locations and maintenance services for decades. One 1950s-era Gulf Oil map pledged that weekly and daily cleaning and maintenance schedules are followed, and hourly inspections made to further assure you and other members of your family of finding restrooms in the cleanest possible condition at all times. Judging from our experience, that commitment had waned considerably by the 1970s. What hadn't faded, however, was the popularity of free maps. In 1972, service stations handed out more than 250 million free road maps, far more than one for every American at the time. Never one to pass on free anything, my father made sure to grab a couple or six maps on every visit. But for longer trips, he provided my sister with a vastly superior navigation tool, the Triptych, a personalized travel guide lovingly handcrafted at the local branch of the AAA. In its day, the AAA Triptych was the pinnacle of sleek, user-friendly highway navigation. The Triptych was, and still is, Triptychs are still offered at a limited number of AAA branches, a long, slender flipbook of paper maps, each detailing a short stretch of highway along the route to a selected destination. On each page, the route was visually lifted off the surrounding landscape and highlighted in bright orange marker by a AAA travel specialist. Rest stops were called out and exits listed by number, and symbols indicated AAA-approved service stations, restaurants, and other services. The idea was that drivers could travel from the top of a page to its bottom, then flip to the next, seeing in advance what they could expect along the way. Each triptych had to be compiled and collated by hand, from the point of origin to the destination, and every section of highway in between. This time-consuming process was conducted in a face-to-face meeting between the AAA specialist and member at a local branch, during which the specialist might also note areas of road construction, can't-miss attractions, and other items of interest. For my father, triptychs alone were worth the cost of his annual AAA membership dues. The discounts he received by flashing his AAA membership card at hotels and restaurants were just icing on the cake. In the 1970s,
Triptychs seemed modern and efficient, but the idea had been around for decades. In 1911, an adventurous motorist visited a AAA branch for assistance planning a drive from New York to Jacksonville, Florida. Realizing he couldn't offer the man a single map that detailed the complete route, a helpful AAA employee pieced one together using portions of several maps and some tape. The concept proved so useful that AAA adopted the idea for use nationwide. Triptychs were terrific in concept, but not without drawbacks in actual use, as we discovered. Unlike modern GPS devices, triptychs were created from pages of highway sections printed far in advance of when they were used, meaning they couldn't be quickly updated for road closures caused by construction or other issues. This was a particular problem for us, as many of the roads we traveled into the Deep South were prone to flooding. When authorities were forced to close highways, we had to improvise our own detours on the spot. For this purpose, triptychs were unhelpful, to say the least. All the features that made the triptych so easy to use, the way the route was visually isolated from the surrounding environment, the long, skinny design that made the booklet easy to hold, also made it useless if circumstances required us to stray from the designated route. The triptych showed exits, but not where they led. The lines representing these roads just faded off into a white void, apparently indicating the world came to an abrupt end just a few miles in either direction. By the look of it, circling around a closed highway put us at considerable risk of driving off the edge of the earth. Making matters worse, my father refused to waste money on a road atlas. After all, he reasoned, gas stations gave away road maps for free, and he kept a glove box full of them. This was true. My father did have dozens of free maps of the Milwaukee and Chicago metropolitan areas in his glove compartment. It's just that these maps provided little help navigating the roads of rural Tennessee or Mississippi, where we ran into problems. And although every triptych booklet included a national map in back, each state was about the size of a quarter. Hardly the scale needed to chart an alternate route on state and county roads. As a result, we often found ourselves hopelessly lost. Sometimes we'd lose our way in relatively populated areas, where our biggest challenge would be deciphering verbal directions offered by locals speaking in thick southern accents. On one occasion, after getting directions from a helpful pedestrian in Atlanta, we spent hours searching for Pass Road, the thoroughfare the woman told us would lead us back to the highway. After driving up and down the main drag looking for our turn, it finally occurred to my father that maybe, just maybe, the Paris Road we had passed 34 times might be the turn our helper intended us to take. More often, though, we found ourselves lost in unsettling hinterlands, where death could wait around any turn. One evening, when we got turned around in a remote area of Louisiana, our car was literally chased out of a dark swamp by what I believe to this day was a band of werewolves. My parents claimed it was just a pack of wild dogs, but that was only because they didn't watch Scooby-Doo as I did, and were unaware of what really lurks in the depths of bayou country at night. Even when we managed to remain on the highway, we found trouble on occasion. Sometimes it was our own fault, and by our, I mean it was my dad's fault. Such was the case with a series of heated skirmishes between Mom and Dad in what came to be known as the Battle of E. The E in question referred to the letter on our fuel gauge, the one indicating the gas tank was near empty. At least, it indicated such to most people. To my father, the E stood for something more like, eh? A sort of half-hearted heads-up that somewhere along the next 100 miles, if it was convenient, it might be good to look for an exit with a service station. Based on previous experience and an understanding of automotive engineering standards known only to him, my father claimed that every automaker made sure at least 40 miles worth of gas remained in the tank after the needle dropped to E, and the low fuel light blinked on. He insisted that engineers intentionally calibrated fuel gauges to be on the safe side. To be fair, my father had gathered considerable support for his case, having personally tested his theory many times over the years, much to our collective dismay. And though we'd never run out of gas, I was positive that on more than one occasion, we'd rolled up to a fuel pump on nothing but the last lingering fumes remaining in the carburetor. As a rule, the needle on our fuel gauge would always drop to E when we were as far as possible from, well, anywhere. In the 1970s, this was a much easier place to be. There was far less development, particularly along the new interstates. Urban sprawl was still in its infancy, making the distance between cities seem far greater. What's more, there were fewer exits with services along the interstates. Interestingly, there were actually more gas stations in the United States in the 1970s than today, substantially more. For a variety of reasons, including gas shortages, shrinking profit margins, and the consolidation of major oil companies, the number of gas stations in America has decreased virtually every year since 1973. In fact, when the routes of the interstates were being determined, one of the main objectives was to bypass towns where services such as gas stations and restaurants were already located. This was to hold down costs, as real estate in developed areas was more expensive. Making matters worse, our family trips nearly always led us into the Deep South. We traveled through large swaths of Tennessee, Arkansas, Mississippi, and Louisiana, some of the least developed and most sparsely populated areas east of the Mississippi. As a result, my father's stubbornness in pushing the limits of our fuel tank often left us facing the possibility of spending much of our vacation stranded on the shoulder of a lonely highway, rather than relaxing on a sunny beach. My parents' difference of opinion over the best time to refuel made for some uneasy moments. Upon seeing the fuel needle drop below a quarter tank, my mom would begin dropping not-so-subtle hints. "We should probably think about getting gas soon," she'd casually mentioned to my dad. "There's an exit coming up. I think I saw a sign a ways back." "We've got plenty of fuel yet," Dad would respond. "No sense stopping sooner than we have to. We'll lose 20 minutes just getting off and on the highway." It's here that I should point out my father's motivation for stretching every tank. He was obsessed with what he called making time. Essentially, making time meant nothing more than progressing toward the day's destination as quickly as we could. It was sort of a competition between my father and the laws of physics. He wanted to get wherever we were headed in a time faster than should be possible. "Hey, we're making great time, everybody," Dad would announce at random intervals. "We're averaging 57.3 miles per hour, with stops. At this rate, we'll make Murfreesboro by 6. Of course, it made no difference if we made Murfreesboro by 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, or 10 o'clock. For my father, that wasn't the point. He just wanted to prove it could be done. In his ongoing quest to make time, my father was relentless. Speed limits were pushed, meals skipped, and requests for potty stops mercilessly ignored. To this day, I'm convinced my bladder is stretched to 4 times the size of the average human's because of the countless hours I spent holding my pee as a child in the cause of making time. As the miles passed and the needle dropped lower, my mom's comments would grow more pointed. "We're on E now, Chuck. We should get off at the next exit." At this point, Dad would employ his favorite delaying gambit, the small town up ahead with added bonus. "You know, hun, we should be able to make Bumbleberg no problem," he'd begin. "It's just a few miles farther, and I think they have a McDonald's there, too. We could get gas, coffee, and burgers for the kids, all in one stop." And with that, we'd pass by the next exit with its easy off-ramp leading directly into a brightly lit Sinclair gas station just off the interstate. Without fail, just past the exit, we'd see a road sign listing the distances to upcoming destinations. Sure, there might be exits for a town or two in the next 10 miles, but they would have names like Dyersville or Desperation Point. What's more, a quick check of the triptych would show that although they had exits, the actual towns lay literally off the map and had no symbols for services of any kind. Then, at the very bottom of the sign, we'd see the town Dad had mentioned as our destination and its distance. 39 miles. It was at this point, as we continued along a highway suddenly devoid of other traffic, that our car would grow very quiet. We would each retreat into our private worlds, hoping against hope that Dad's theory held water, not to mention 40 miles worth of fuel. As the reality of our situation settled in, Mom would read Dad the Riot Act. She might even work in a few tears as she'd let loose on how he never listened to her about filling up when it was convenient, how he always had to push it. Ever the cool customer, Dad would confidently reply there was nothing to worry about. We'd make it to Bumbleburg with fuel to spare. But afterward, he'd become as silent as the rest of us, knowing deep down it was going to be close. And though we'd all been down this road many times before, literally and figuratively, he knew that this just might be the day his luck and our tank would run out. As the minutes passed along with the miles, we'd all edge up on our seats and crane our necks to get a better look at the fuel gauge. Just as the fuel needle would drop below the white line pointing to E, we'd see the next road sign. Bumbleburg, 17 miles. We'd swallow hard, and our eyes would dart from side to side like the crowd following the action at a tennis match, from the fuel gauge to the road, to the fuel gauge to the road, searching desperately for an illuminated sign, a billboard, any trace whatsoever of civilization ahead. More than once, I'd also looked over at Dad to see the calm expression on his face betrayed by tiny beads of perspiration. Whether by divine inspiration or sheer luck, we always made it to Bumbleburg or Snipesville, or whatever other town would be our salvation. Like the lookout up in a ship's crow's nest searching for land, one of us would finally thrust a finger forward and cry out that a gas station sign was jutting up from the horizon. Then we'd sweat out a few last anxious moments as our car coasted on its last drops of fuel into the station and up to the pump. Without a word, we'd simultaneously pop open our car doors, as much to release the pent-up tension as to file outside to use the restroom, and offer up a silent prayer of thanks. After a short break, we'd return to our seats and head back out on the highway, only to repeat the whole episode all over again, exactly one tank full of gas later. And so the Battle of E would play out time and again, trip after trip, tank full of fuel after tank full of fuel. That is, until one rainy evening on an interstate outside Little Rock, Arkansas, in 1978. That's when the great debate over how far below E is empty came to its inevitable sputtering conclusion. Just as we neared the exit that would convey us to the gas station that would be our salvation, the engine of our Ford Country Squire station wagon wheezed a gasp and quit. As my father struggled to guide our suddenly silent car, now without the benefit of power steering, over to the shoulder, no one spoke a word. What was there to say? My father couldn't offer up a word in his defense without it sounding as hollow and empty as the gas tank that had betrayed him. My mother couldn't take any satisfaction in being right, because she'd soon be looking after four kids in a stalled station wagon on a dark and rainy highway. And perhaps all of us knew this would be the end of a family tradition. There'd be no more squabbling about when we'd stop to refuel. No more anxious moments of suspense to punctuate the hours of monotony out on the open road. Clearly, the future would be less exciting. So we just sat quietly, staring into the drizzly darkness of the Arkansas night. Not far off in the distance ahead, we could make out the hazy white glow of fluorescent lights hanging above the gas station that was our destination. My father zipped up the collar of his jacket, pulled a hat down over his brow, and pulled the car door handle. Then he set out into the night, no doubt muttering unspeakable curses under his breath about a nameless, negligent Ford engineer who'd calibrated a fuel gauge to leave just 39 miles worth of fuel below the line pointing to E. On our family road trips, nearly running out of gas wasn't a rare event. It was as common as having to roll down the windows because someone released a silent but deadly fart, a frequent occurrence in a car packed with six people whose every meal consisted of greasy fast food hamburgers, fries, and Coke. Sure, my dad's ongoing crusade to make time accounted for many near misses, but there were other reasons. It didn't help that we drove gas-guzzling land yachts that averaged 10 miles per gallon, even before being loaded with 6 people and a mountain of luggage. At the rate our cars burned gas, we went through a half tank before we made it from the pump to the on-ramp. But another factor was the swift demise of a once popular chain named Stuckey's. One of the greatest success stories of the American highway boom, Stuckey's began as a single wooden stand located along U.S. Route 23 near Eastman, Georgia, in the early 1930s. It was there that Williamson S. Bill Stuckey, a pecan farmer sitting on a bumper crop, decided to hawk some nuts to the scores of motorists zipping along the highway en route to Florida. The stand was an instant hit. Sensing an opportunity, Stuckey sent his wife Ethel into the kitchen. Soon, motorists were toting off bags of Ethel's original pecan log rolls, pecan divinity, and other tasty homemade pecan treats as fast as she could pull the trays from her oven. As word spread, and customers returned year after year, Stuckey built a permanent structure boasting a sit-down restaurant, souvenir shop, gas pumps, and, most notable, a teal shingled roof that would become Stuckey's trademark. Like the stand it replaced, the new Stuckey's was a resounding success. Bill Stuckey began opening new stores as fast as he could secure financing. Corporate lore holds that he determined locations based on a simple but reliable tool: his bladder. Starting from nearby Atlanta, Stuckey set out on the highway and drove until he could no longer hold back the urge to relieve himself. Reasoning that other travelers would have to do the same, Stuckey marked the spot, presumably on a map and not by, ahem, other means, then drove until he felt the urge again. He noted the new spot on his map, and so on. The system likely not only determined the placement of Stuckey's stores, but also inspired its commitment to clean restrooms. After franchising the concept, Stuckey's stores fanned out across America's southeast. By the mid-1960s, the chain's signature teal-roofed buildings were nearly as iconic as the Golden Arches of McDonald's. Even more ubiquitous than Stuckey's stores were the chain's distinctive yellow and red billboards. Not wanting to leave a customer's decision to stop at one of his stores strictly to the call of nature, Bill Stuckey erected an astounding 6,000 billboards on highways across the South, as many as 50 for a single location. Years later, it would be these billboards that would often result in my family's nearly getting stuck instead of at the site of an operating Stuckey's. With sales still on the upswing, Bill Stuckey decided to sell the prospering chain in 1964, but the new management failed to keep Stuckey's in tune with the times. By the early 1970s, traveling families were bypassing Stuckey's and its sit-down diner fare for the faster meals available at McDonald's, Burger King, and Hardee's. Gas-pumping convenience stores like 7-Eleven and convenience-pumping gas stations like Amoco Gas and Food Marts introduced more competition. After peaking at 360 locations in the early 1970s, Stuckey's stores closed in scores. By 1984, fewer than 75 remained. In many locations, franchise owners simply locked the doors and walked away. In others, franchisees stopped serving food and pumping gas, focusing instead on selling the pecan treats and kitschy novelties that had originally built the brand. But while Stuckey's stores disappeared or changed, their billboards didn't. Thanks to Bill Stuckey's overly diligent efforts decades before, dozens of boards remained by the roadside, promising motorists delicious food, cheap fuel, and clean restrooms just ahead. Preoccupied with boarding up windows and tearing out gas pumps, owners of many failed or foundering Stuckey's franchises never thought to take down their billboards. It was an oversight that proved particularly vexing for travelers who rolled into the parking lot of a Stuckey's store with full bladders and empty gas tanks, only to find a chained front door and cobweb-covered gas pumps. All too often in the late 1970s, those travelers were us. On more than a few occasions when we were running on empty, we'd spot a Stuckey's billboard. "Look," my dad would announce, pointing to the garish red and yellow sign. "See? We've got nothing to worry about. There's a Stuckey's 8 miles ahead and they've got gas." We'd all let out a sigh of relief, confident we'd once again taunted the fuel gods and lived to tell the tale. Or so we thought. After traveling the 8 miles, another Stuckey's billboard would appear and Dad would exit. Meanwhile, my brothers and I would prepare to jump out of the back seat to use the facilities, or just browse the novelty aisle for a genuine imitation animal skin Indian drum, while Dad filled up. Perhaps we'd even try to talk Mom into purchasing a box of pecan caramels to gobble on the road. But as we'd pull into the parking lot, our hearts would sink. We'd see that the store's interior was dark, or spot a torn screen hanging forlornly from the front door, a sure tip-off that something was amiss. Other times the store would be open, but the gas pumps were wrapped tightly in plastic. We'd watch through the front windows as my dad would go inside to ask about gas, only to see the manager shrug his shoulders and point a finger down the highway. Exasperated, my dad would climb back behind the wheel. The rest of us would slump back into our seats. Without a word, Dad would turn the key and steer our car back onto the on-ramp. With our fuel needles sinking ever lower below E, we traveled on. Somehow we always managed to make it, though, and Stuckey's would too. Stuckey's salvation would be Bill Stuckey Jr., who repurchased the failing chain in 1985 in hopes of restoring its former glory. Under Bill Jr.'s direction, Stuckey's updated its approach and has modestly rebounded, with more than 100 franchises in 17 states. For the record, though, you may want to note that while you can look forward to stopping at Stuckey's for tasty pecan candies, nuts, and souvenirs, the chain no longer sells gas. Motorists didn't always have to wait until the next exit to find some essential services. Thankfully, the planners of the interstates built some handy stops right into their highways. I'm speaking, of course, of the nation's collection of rest areas. While rest areas didn't sell gas, they did and still do offer travelers convenient places to pull off the road and enjoy a picnic lunch, use the restrooms, consult a map, and, in many locations, even get a quick education in the history and culture of the local surroundings. My family stopped at rest areas only in the most dire of circumstances, when we were dragging a sparking muffler down the highway, or my dad had miscalculated the effect an extra cup of coffee at breakfast would have on his bladder. But for many families, stops at rest areas were a mainstay of the family road trip experience, and for that they owe a debt of thanks to a considerate young man employed by a Midwestern highway department, at least according to an article printed in American Road Builder magazine in 1957. As the story goes, sometime in the late 1920s, Alan Williams was driving along a rural highway when he came on an amusing scene. A traveling family had parked its car in a shady spot near a small pond and was attempting to enjoy a peaceful picnic lunch. Only no one appeared relaxed. The harried mother hovered over a tree stump she was using as a makeshift table, trying to fit one more serving dish on top without knocking several others off. With no place to sit and eat, a child sat cross-legged on the grass, eating her sandwich, while keeping a watchful eye on an approaching squirrel. A few yards away, a boy was awkwardly perched on a large rock, his plate sliding off his lap. Meanwhile, the father stood nearby and danced a kind of jig, balancing several plates and glasses in his arms while attempting to shovel a forkful of food into his mouth. William simply smiled and drove on, but the scene stayed with him. After all, he wondered, shouldn't travelers have convenient places to pull off the road and take a break? Somewhere to get out, stretch their legs, and grab a bite to eat after driving long miles of bumpy roads? Fortunately, Williams held a position in which he could act on his idea. As a young engineer and manager for the Road Commission in Ionia County, Michigan, it was Williams's job to make the roads in his jurisdiction safe and pleasant for motorists. Months later, an opportunity presented itself. Williams found himself holed up in a county garage with an idle snowplowing crew, awaiting the arrival of an expected snowstorm. Rather than fritter away the time playing gin rummy, Williams set his men to work on a project. Using odd lengths of 2x4 scrap lumber piled in a corner, Williams directed his crew to knock together a few simple picnic tables. Finding some leftover paint, the men brushed a thick coat of pine green on each. When spring came, Williams and his crew loaded the tables on a truck and drove them to a scenic spot he picked out along Route 16, 3 miles south of the village of Saranac. The tables were neatly arranged on a patch of grass in the shade of some sturdy oaks, within clear sight of passing motorists. Not long after, a trickle of letters began arriving on the desk of B.C. Tiny, chief maintenance engineer of the Michigan State Highway Department. Each dispatch had been sent by a delighted traveler, lauding the department for its thoughtfulness in providing such an inviting picnic spot. Confused, Tiny looked into the matter. Learning what Williams had done, Tiny decided he liked the idea, not to mention the attention it brought his department. He authorized the establishment of more roadside picnic sites along Michigan highways. Word traveled fast, as you might expect of an idea spread mainly by tourists, and soon states across the nation got to work creating their own roadside stops. In the blink of an eye, rest areas became as common along America's highways as patrol cars and roadkill. Technically, these first rest areas weren't known as such. They were called roadside parks, or waysides. The transition to a new term didn't occur until planning began for construction of America's interstate highway system in the late 1950s. Even then, such off-road refuges were officially designated safety rest areas. As the term implies, safety rest areas, SRAs, were included along the interstates as much to offer motorists a safe place to pull off the road in the event of emergencies or mechanical issues, as they were to offer road-weary travelers a place to enjoy picnic lunches and use the toilet. In outlying areas, developers of the interstates knew it would be years before motorists could depend on finding nearby restaurants and service stations. SRAs were intended to help fill that void. In 1958, planners of the interstate highway system issued a policy document spelling out a standardized basic layout for safety rest areas. In general, each SRA was to consist of a main building providing toilet facilities and a drinking fountain, a separate picnic shelter, a kiosk to provide basic travel information, and a large parking lot. Freeway-type entrance and exit ramps were to be built to provide safe and easy access, without requiring motorists to actually leave the restricted space of the interstate. Finally, the SRAs were to be staffed or visited regularly by state employees to ensure proper maintenance of the facilities and to render any necessary assistance to motorists. But while federal policy dictated how SRAs should be constructed and function, it offered no guidelines on how the buildings should look. This meant the aesthetic design of the facilities was left largely up to state officials and the architects they hired. As federal funding for SRAs was continually slashed and the burden of paying for their construction shifted to the states, local decision makers gained even more creative latitude. The results were often charming, sometimes quirky, and in some instances nothing less than dazzling. To understand why local officials became interested in making rest areas more than functional public facilities, it's important to remember that prior to the interstates, road travel was a much more leisurely proposition. Motorists navigated the country on two-lane highways, and stops and slowdowns at crossroads and intersections were common. In towns, traffic could back up for any number of reasons, from a slow-moving wagon making deliveries to a community festival in the central square. Travelers might decide to stop off and buy fresh produce at a roadside stand or enjoy a meal at a local cafe or diner. It made for slow going. But it also offered tourists the chance to look around and absorb the local flavor, with each region and community leaving its own indelible impression. The construction of the interstates changed all that. By design, the new superhighways minimized motorists' contact with the world beyond the asphalt. To keep traffic moving at top speed, intersections were eliminated and access limited. Faster travel speeds also demanded that drivers keep their eyes on the road ahead, rather than the scenery off to each side. Even when travelers could cast a glance off the interstate, they were able to see far less. What's more, to promote rainwater runoff and prevent flooding, the new interstates were elevated well above the surrounding landscape. It meant that motorists on the interstates now traveled over the country rather than through it. In a very real sense, travelers were able to cross